Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. It's a time dedicated to raising awareness about this global health challenge, while emphasizing the importance of early detection and treatment.
Breast cancer is actually one of the most treatable cancers if found early. And breast cancer mortality rates have fallen by about 43% since 1989. You know, and a lot of that is due to screening. Some is new to better therapies.
That is Dr. William Dehert. He's the Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. He joins us to talk about some of the breakthroughs in cancer research and therapies to treat a disease that affects millions in Africa and around the world. An award-winning musician and multi-instrumentalist talks to me about the power of music as a form of therapy.
The number one thing that inspires me are the people and community and bringing people together through music. To me, it just feels like something God sent that I was, you know, able to be on this earth to bring people together.
That is Melanie Edwards. She talks to us about her journey as an artist and the community musical mending workshops, which she started during the pandemic. But first, as always, we hear from you, our listeners. We asked, what are the factors driving the persistent negative perceptions and representations of Africa in the West? Here is what you said.
I think the media has played a role in the way people view Africa. Much as bad governance is there, but still the way the media portrays it to the world. Because when you talk of bad governance, even in the West, even in the East, the leaders are bad. But why Africa only?
I think it's bad leadership that makes the West to have bad image of Africa. I think if the leaders have a positivity in their leadership, it will be much better. Our image will be much better.
Speaking like someone who is living outside, I see like racism is still there. They look at a black person like they're looking at a failure, and they think you're poor. That means your knowledge itself is poor. But this is not true. You see, we have some of the black people, some people from Africa who have achieved something, who have put something on the map. You see, so it's all about giving us chance, giving the youth chance, and see what they can do.
There's this side of the Western media which is happy to show the always bad side of Africa, not giving a lot of time to the little or huge development programs which are successful in Africa. They are very good successful stories to be told, but they are given a little time in Western media.
Yes!
Yo, right now you sitting back and relaxing to my man Jackson on the Upfront on the Voice of America, outspoken alpha intellect.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Studies show that breast cancer is the leading cause of cancer-related death among women worldwide. The deadly disease remains a major public health concern in sub-Saharan Africa, as death rates are disproportionately higher than in more developed regions. That is despite a lower disease incidence. Health experts attribute this to a lack of resources for early detection and treatment. In fact, doctors encourage people to go for regular checkups because the earlier it is diagnosed, the easier it is to treat. Dr. William Dehert is the Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. He joins me to talk about some of the breakthroughs in cancer research and therapies to treat a disease that affects millions in Africa and around the world. Dr. Dehert, thank you so much for joining us. Let me start off by asking you, what is the significance of Breast Cancer Awareness Month?
So breast cancer is actually one of the most treatable cancers if found early. And breast cancer mortality rates have fallen by about 43% since 1989. You know, and a lot of that is due to screening. Some is new to better therapies. And so Breast Cancer Awareness Month is really an opportunity to remind women that screenings can actually have a real impact on their likelihood of actually, you know, dying from breast cancer. And so, you know, I think that's the importance that people understand that screenings do have an impact, and regular screenings in particular really impact how long regular screenings in particular can impact women's chances of dying from breast cancer.
And what are some of the risk factors for developing breast cancer? And what are some of the recommended methods for early detection of breast cancer?
Yeah, so the greatest risk factor for breast cancer is probably age, where that's a little hard to change. To give you some numbers on that, if you're under 40, your risk of breast cancer is about 15 per 100,000. But if you're over 65, it's about 443 per 100,000. So aging is probably the greatest risk. But other risk factors include, a family history of breast cancer for particular, certain inherited genetic mutations. And then there's sort of a obesity in sort of the postmenopausal woman is probably a risk for breast cancer too. So in younger women, particularly those who have a family history, it may make sense to actually start screening earlier. And if you're in your 30s and undergoing screening, then, you know, probably a mammogram by itself may not be enough, and you may also need an ultrasound or a MRI.
And how has the Breast Cancer Awareness Month contributed to advancement in breast cancer research and treatment?
Well, I think awareness for breast cancer has been, very important in sort of rallying support for research. You know, at the American Cancer Society, you know, currently we have about $127 million out in funded breast cancer grants. And I think a lot of the focus on breast cancer is due to activities such as Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So I think it has been important. And I think also it's a good reminder for folks, you know, it's October, you know, kids are back in school, football season's ongoing. We have some relationships, you know, with the NFL as far as crucial catch. These reminders to get your screening, because, you know, we do have data that, you know, missing scheduled mammographies can definitely increase your risk of from death from breast cancer.
Are there any recent breakthroughs or developments in breast cancer research or treatment that you can highlight for us?
Yeah, so I think looking at women who actually develop breast cancer with more advanced disease, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been actually multiple new therapies approved that are much more precision-based. So we do know which women are most likely to benefit from immunotherapy. We know we have better treatments available for women with breast cancer who have the BRCA mutation. And I think a very important discovery, which led to FDA approval, was a drug for what we call low HER2. So HER2 is a marker expressed on breast cancer tumor cells that's not present for all women. But there's a drug for medical drugs for HER2. But now with the discovery that there's a drug for what we call low HER2, so a very low expression, you know, has increased the armamentarium for therapies for women. So there have been, you know, several new advances for women for the treatment of breast cancer.
And finally, Dr. Dehart, what are some of the common myths and misconceptions about breast cancer that need to be addressed during this month?
So I think that's a great question. I think there's a myth that some people have, you know, that screenings don't help. You know, we know there's about 10% of women have never had a screening, and we know many women are not really, up to date on the screening. So I think the importance of actually undergoing screening and having an impact on breast cancer mortality is really important. And the second thing that's important is that if you find a cancer early on, you know, the treatments are much less toxic and much less invasive than if you have an advanced breast cancer. So finding a small cancer is much easier for us to treat. And so I think the fear of finding a cancer and how that would cause, you know, significant, you know, pain, disfigurement, and other aspects, actually delays people being screened. And actually, if they're screened, the treatments are much easier.
Dr. Dehart, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
That is Dr. William Dehart. He's the Chief Scientific Officer for the American Cancer Society. He joined me via phone from his offices here in Washington. According to the American National Cancer Institute, breast cancer is the most commonly occurring cancer in women and the most common cancer overall. And even though there have been advancements in treating the disease with new tools and medication available to people in developed countries, studies show that survival rates, that's after diagnosis, in sub-Saharan Africa stands at around 40% compared to the over 90% rate in most rich nations. Fiona Wamayi is a Ugandan journalist based in Washington. I asked her about her experience and awareness about breast cancer. So Fiona, thank you so much for joining us. Have you actually ever had to go in to have a checkup, a mammography?
I have had checkups, but I've not had a mammography.
Is this something that you've had either doctors or parents or teachers encouraging you to do?
Absolutely. Growing up back in Uganda, we used to have, I think we still have them, the senior women teachers, and part of their duties was to encourage girls to know about their health.
Mm.
So October being the Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we were always encouraged and taught how to self-examine.
So self-examination, but were there facilities or hospitals or clinics where you would go in and have a medical professional check you?
Not really. Well, they were hospitals, but most of the times the people who would go to the hospitals, unfortunately, would get there when it's already too late.
Right. And actually, that's what the WHO and other health experts say, that in Africa, most of the cases that lead to death is because people have not had early detection, early checkups. Now, is this something that you're aware about, that you have to have an annual check?
Personally, I have been lucky that, yes, it is something I have been aware of since I was at least 12 years. So, yes, I knew. We were encouraged, like I say, the senior women teacher, they always encouraged us to do the self-check. And we were told that if you hear, you feel something, then you can go to the hospital.
If you feel a lump in your breast.
If you feel a lump.
Okay.
But also, even when I went to the hospital for the checks, what they would do a physical check. Like the doctor would come and, you know, like physically touch your breasts, you know, just to feel for the lump.
Yeah.
So,
but not necessarily doing a mammography.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
No.
When you go for your physicals, your annual physicals, is that something that you ask them to do?
It's the other way around.
Mm.
They do the
it's part of the checkup.
Yes,
they do. So when you come in, you will know, you'll do everything else, blood work and everything, and then they'll do a mammography?
They also...
Not necessarily a mammography,
and
I guess.
I'm speaking for me,
yeah.
from personal experience. I have never had them do a mammography on me. They have done the personal and the physical check, the physical breast exams, where I lie down and then they physically check for the...
Is this something that, you know, as a woman, you worry about, you even think about at all?
Absolutely. Although I think as I get older and some things, you know, like they become part of me, where we were always encouraged, once you go to the bathroom, as you're going to shower, one of the things you have to always do is to do a physical check.
A personal physical check
of your breasts, especially if you're about to have your menstrual period. So personally, it is something that has almost always been a part of me.
Do you have any people in your family or in your friendship network or circle that have had to deal with breast cancer?
Unfortunately, yes. Not in my family, but in school, we actually, I know a few people who died, who suffered from breast cancer. Again, like I said, there wasn't...
In high school?
High school and at the university.
At that young age?
Oh, yeah, they were in their 20s. You know, there was one when I was working who was, I think, in their 30s or something, but I know at least two that I lost.
What kind of care is there in Uganda or in your home area where you grew up? What kind of care is there available to a person who has breast cancer?
Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of care, as should be. You find that sometimes, for lack of a better word, I say it's almost always like a death sentence. You know, if someone is found to have cancer, and again, like I said, by the time they find you find out you're diagnosed, it's almost always too late.
Yeah,
almost always too late.
And that's the sad thing.
It is,
because
yeah.
It is actually treatable.
It is. Having said that, though, there is also there is an association in Kampala, and they are survivors. So in the recent past, there's been a lot more awareness.
October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Is that something that you knew about? Is that something that you actually know?
I personally did. In fact, again, like I said, at school, we almost always were encouraged to make the pink ribbons and also wear pink. I have kind of lost my touch of that, but I used to do that every October. So yes, it is something that I was aware about.
That was Fiona Wamayi, a journalist from Uganda. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Now, music therapy is a well-known, established form of therapy that uses music as a therapeutic tool to address physical, emotional, cognitive, and social needs of individuals. Our next guest believes very much in the power of music to help reduce stress or improving the general quality of life. Melanie Edwards is an award-winning musician and multi-instrumentalist based in the Washington, D.C. area. During the pandemic, Melanie developed music mending workshops, performing for groups of people in hospitals, playing bedside performances, as well as in assisted living facilities, nursing homes, and rehab centers. She says that even in this post-pandemic period, music mending workshops are necessary as people still battle with all kinds of mental health challenges and post-traumatic stress.
So it begins, it ends.
Let me ask you to tell us about yourself and your music and, you know, what inspires you to do what you do.
Oh my goodness. Well, the number one thing that inspires me are the people and community and bringing people together through music. To me, it just feels like something God sent that I was, you know, able to be on this earth to bring people together with the power of music. It's Absolutely. A universal language. It connects all of us. It binds all of us. I see smiles in the room when people are getting together, creating music. It's like food in that way.
You can never
you know?
Be sad when there's music.
No, you know what I'm saying? You cannot
so
be sad.
You're very lucky. You're blessed to have the gift and to share, to be able to share
Thank
that
you.
Gift with the rest of the world.
Thank
so, when we last spoke to you, you were about to embark on a trip to the motherland.
Yes, to
the continent
motherland.
Of Africa. How did that go for you?
Oh my goodness. It was absolutely amazing. Right away, I was greeted with such hospitality. Yes. I don't think I've ever had such hospitality as the entire, I mean, every country in Africa was just overwhelming.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah.
What were some of the highlights of your trip?
Oh my gosh. Well, one of my favorite things was actually being able to sing with some African villagers, actually. I showed up to an event and they were kind of playing some instruments off to the side. And they just, you know, said, join us. And I said, all right. And I just started singing with
You're
them.
You're like, say less, I'm
yeah.
here. Which country was that?
This was in Tanzania.
Okay.
And it was just absolutely incredible. They gave me some instruments, handmade instruments. And we just started having a jam session, singing together, just going off the cuff. It felt just so warm and embracing and just lovely.
And
right away. So I was like, this is heaven. This is,
it.
Yeah.
So how did your journey into music start?
It started at a young age. I was starting to sing around 3 years old, And then I started to play the piano and violin at 9 years old. And my family were in the church. My grandfather was a pastor. And, you know, if you grow up in a church, you're not getting away from the music portion of it. And so I was singing away.
Music is such a central part of church experience.
Absolutely. And so I kind of learned straight away, you know, Wednesday nights, Sundays, you're going to pop up there and sing or supplement whatever's not going on. You're going to play violin. Okay, you're going to play piano. Okay, you're going to sing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just kind of
woman band.
Yes. They like that too because we have, you know, free charge there.
They're love to see a music video of you playing all your instruments
at the same time.
I'm sure there's AI can do something with that.
Oh, good idea.
But again, you know, you're a multi-instrumentalist, if I didn't make that clear to our listeners. You play multiple instruments. Again, such a gift
to have.
Which one is your favorite instrument?
Oh, that's so hard. It's like, what's your favorite kid?
Yeah.
You know, some are grumpier than others. Some aren't having a day and they don't want to be messed with except Friday nights.
Yeah.
They kind of have their own personality. I would say I really like playing the piano because I'm able to sing with it and get the audience on board with piano. But however, I really love the violin because it's so moody and emotional. I started playing the organ recently. The organ adds a lot of flavor and a lot of drama. You know, it just depends on kind of the scene and the mood.
Mm.
And I just love to sing even without instruments and just have that kind of voice, that kind of soul connection where you're just coming from space and filling space with singing. So it really just depends on the mood and the flavor and, you know.
So this year we are celebrating 50 years of hip hop, and you do have a past relationship or connection to the genre of hip-hop music.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I was really lucky and fortunate to be able to be a hip-hop violinist in a group called BR and Time Bomb, and that was in Brooklyn, New York City. And I started playing with them around 2005, and we played a good solid 10 years just everywhere. We had an awesome time. We did festivals. We did different underground things in the subway. We did pop-up things. I mean, we had, you know, we played at the Bitter End down in the middle of Lower East Side. I mean, you name it and we were there. And it
now,
was just fantastic.
Now, when people hear violin and hip-hop, you're able to fuse it and create the beautiful music.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did that start, like that relationship for you?
Well, that relationship started organically. I had a friend, her name was Olivia. She also played violin. She's fantastic. She was trained by Yo-Yo Ma. We know the level we're dealing with here. Absolutely amazing. And she was like, you know, Melanie, you should come join us. I had an electric violin. She had an acoustic. And we were like, this is going to sound really cool to put the two together because mine has the dynamics go up and down and make all these crazy noises and, you know, disdain, all these neat things like that. So we got together and it just started jamming like no other. We were able to do harmonies, riffs off each other, you know, in the hip hop line, it's really crucial to have that kind of cool riff coming in. The violin really seals that and makes that really spread, you know, and you'll miss it when you don't hear it. When you get used to the song and you pull the violin out, you're like, whoa, I need that violin back, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's where I started, and we just started working together and maintaining, and then she would sub for me sometimes, I would sub for her, sometimes we play together. We just got on this kind of cool kick together.
Mm.
And that's how it began.
How has your music evolved over the years?
Wow, that is a great question. You know, I think it has changed and morphed over the years because I've been putting more of a practitioner work to it, more of a healing component to it. I still love singer-songwriter style. I still love to go perform in concerts and perform out. It's one of my favorite things to do. But the difference in the shift now is that I'm doing it as a service. I'm actually going into hospitals, communities, nursing homes, centers, different places where I'm using it as a healing modality to help people connect, to help people heal, to help people kind of communicate when sometimes we're won't work, I use music, right? And so that's a way that we can kind of get together, connect, and I can kind of bring a different service to it, a different slant. And so it's morphed more into a very personal kind of one-on-one, even individual modality versus that whole gig party, you know, concert, which I still adore and love.
Right.
But it's just, it's taken on a more serious.
Yeah, it has its place. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to sing for us one of your favorite songs, just a little snippet of it.
Okay, one of my favorite ones.
I want to hear your beautiful voice.
One of my own that I wrote, or like a
your own?
One of my own. No one is calling. I'ma keep on rolling because I know that I'm the one to blame. I can't keep trying, I know that I'm lying, but even though I know I'm the one to blame.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, the last time we chatted, it was during the pandemic, right? Remember that?
Yes,
And, you know, such a gloomy time in the world.
Yeah.
so much uncertainty, but music was filling some of those spaces. And I remember coming to your place and you played for us violin and your piano, beautiful. And you were talking about how, where, again, like you said, where everything else fails, music fills up that space.
Right.
What has been the role of music coming out of the pandemic in this post-pandemic world that we're in?
Oh my goodness. I am so excited about what has happened, even though that was such a horrific moment in time where we were all shut away from each other and isolated. Now, pushing forward, it's been absolutely a joy and privilege, and it's just manifested beyond my wildest dreams. I'm literally working around the clock. I'm working so much I can't even see everybody. And this, to me, tells me that there was such a need. It was so significant and so important in people's lives that it was the one thing that they held on to and remained close with during this isolation. And I have noticed a trend in a much better, positive way of people coming together and truly connecting and being even more happy with the music, classes, and workshops that I'm bringing to the table. There's more interest, there's more investment. People want to actually come to the shows or come to the workshops and show me the music they have created, what dances they have done to the songs I bring. So not only has it just been me kind of leading it, it's been them taking it off on their own, creating and coming back with their own workshops. That just makes me...
That's lovely.
It's lovely because it's like a positive virus. Absolutely. It was like we had a negative one to shut us down, but this positive virus came out.
And it overpowers.
Yes.
The negative virus.
Yep.
We're going to end it on that. Melanie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jackson, as always.
Thank you for sharing your music, as always.
That was Melanie Edwards, an award-winning musician and multi-instrumentalist. She joined me here in studios. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In Nigeria, finding solutions to the growing trend of out-of-school children has become a national emergency. An estimated 20 million children are not attending school, a situation that experts blame on a mix of cultural, economic, and infrastructure problems, none of which have easy solutions. Gibson Emeka joins us with this story from Abuja in Nigeria.
Joshua Gideon had a public elementary school in Arasabo community in north central Nigeria. While children here want to learn, he says many cannot afford books or other school supply. Not having these children in school, Gideon said, is a recipe for national crisis.
The basic education, which is necessary for an individual to become something in the future, that foundation is not being given to them. Then definitely they will mess up in the community.
The number of children hawking or begging for alms in the street of Nigeria are like the epic challenge. While primary education is officially free and compulsory in Nigeria, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, estimated last year that about 20 million children aged 5 to 14 are not in school. Gideon says one problem is a simple lack of schools.
We don't have enough chairs for these children to be able to settle and read well. Conducive environment is not there. We need buildings. You can see our buildings are already dilapidated.
Another educator, James Rotimi, says cultural and economic factors are also keeping children out of classroom.
There are places where girls are not supposed to go to school, or girls are supposed to be early marriage and child marriage in some places. In other places, conflict, like where you have the Boko Haram crisis, people are displaced. You have economic factors too. A lot of people have to go and work early in life to help and support the family.
The Nigeria Government Universal Basic Education Commission has said the nation needs to build 20,000 new schools with nearly a million classrooms to accommodate out-of-school children. Rotimi believes the government target is a tall ambition.
Where we are today, it's a bit difficult to say we want to achieve that. If you look at the allocation that education gets across the years. In 2016, only 9 trillion naira was allocated to education. That's about 8.4 billion of the national budget, 8.4% of the national budget. But as of 2022, the allocation to education has dropped to 5.4%.
With 42% of Nigeria's current population below age 15, Rotimi says the country needs to find alternative funding channel to ramp up investment in basic education. Gibson Emeka, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to all our guests and to you, our listeners. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Upfront on Instagram and on Facebook. Check out our podcast at voaafrica.com/upfront. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Have a great week ahead, Africa.